to your ears. We're either ringing bells or banging on the fireplace hood. I'm Walt Bowman, and this is the third morning that we are doing a look at songs in the New Testament. And today, some heavy stuff. I called it Evil's Song, The Lament for Murdered Children. But before we get into that, Carl and Herb have prepared for us a review of yesterday, and we'll let Herb introduce it. And
there's a correction again, as you can see. Doxa is praise and doxa near. I wanted to say doxa is praise, doxa is near. But then there comes a composer who says the rhythm is a little wrong, so you have to say doxa is praise and doxa near. We think this is about 95% there. So if you find an error, you're in the 5%. We'll sing it. I think it's beautiful. We don't know what the first or the last stanza is yet, but we'll find that out. Maybe you can help us order these in the sequence, okay?
Sure.
Maybe just sing through it on la to kind of get the feel of it. So it's about like this.
Wonderful to be in on these premieres every day. That's just absolutely super. So Herb and Carl, thank you. My goodness. All right. Don't lose these. May save you buying a book someday. Oh, I'm getting... All right. Today... if you have your Bibles, you can open them up to Matthew 2. While we are on Christmas music, we have to look at one of the stories closely related to Christmas, and that is the story of the murdered children. Interesting thing is that the way Matthew tells the story, as you can see just by comparing, is quite different from the way Luke tells the story. Luke really has nothing of the tragic in his version. One has to sort of imagine it a little, like Mary's going in haste to the hill country and probably getting some misunderstanding, at least, of her situation. then the implicit conflict between Caesar and Jesus as Lord that will, in Luke's gospel, eventually be resolved on the cross as it is in all of the gospels. But the story, at least, basically does not have any of the overt elements of tragedy. Simeon in Luke's gospel talks about how a sword will pierce Mary's heart. So it's there. I mean, we know it in the background, but it is not explicitly there. In Matthew's gospel, we have a different kind of storytelling. And the story is told first through the eyes of Joseph and then through the experience of the Magi, who do not appear in Luke's account at all. And the Magi are simple people, too, in their own way, probably scholars. I identify with them in that sense, and therefore sort of impractical. People who don't really know what the world is all about and who are therefore easily, in a sense, manipulated by Herod. And it's through them, then, that the story gets told, and the tragic is built into it. In fact, in this particular incident, the children the king, a paranoid from the word go. If you know anything at all about the history of Herod, you know that he was, first of all, fairly able. I wonder if in rulers, at least, ability and paranoia don't go hand in hand. Because Herod maintained himself on the throne for a long period of time, died apparently miserably around 4 AD or something like that, some 4 years after this particular incident, but had suspected his own sons, his own family of plotting against him, had his sons executed, his wife executed, lived in that kind of lonely fear that may well be characteristic of Herod's kind of power and Caesar's kind of power altogether. And when he discovers that the wise men have not returned to point the place where this threat to his throne could be, he simply sends his secret police into Bethlehem and slaughters everybody 2 years old and younger just to make sure he gets them all. This story takes us in the middle of Christmas into the deepest levels of evil. And the song that arises from this is the song of lament. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, surely the saddest of all of the Old Testament prophets. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. One of the most moving experiences I've had with this particular text was Columbia record of Gregorian chant done by the monks of Gethsemane Abbey, where Thomas Merton, subject of a later session this morning, where Thomas Merton was a monk, and they were doing the Christmas readings, you know, and they're not like Protestants who finish it all up on Christmas Eve or at the very latest Christmas Day and pack their trees and stuff them out on the snow and so on, so that the day after Christmas you just find used Christmas trees all over. The monks at Gethsemane go through all of the days of Christmas, and the day for the Holy Innocents is what? The 27th, isn't it? Carl, where are you? I think it's the 27th. Right, the 26th is... thought I knew all of that. The 26th is St. Stephen, is it? Let's find December here. 26th is St. Stephen, martyr. 27th is St. John the Evangelist. And the 28th, then, is Holy Innocents. So you have two martyrs and John the Apostle in the 3 days after Christmas. And there, as they were doing this series of Gospels, comes this plaintive Gregorian chant setting of this text of Rachel weeping. I want to spend a little bit of time, therefore, talking about evil in the midst of the Christmas season. There is natural evil, but in the final analysis, natural evil is in many ways more bearable than the kind of evil that is being talked about here. Natural evil, I'm talking about now disease or natural catastrophes, storm, fire, and so on. Here we are dealing with human evil. Natural evil is the subject of Murphy's Law, and I just brought along a few corollaries. Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, it will. Corollaries, left to themselves, things tend to go from bad to worse. Lily Tomlin's adaptation of that is things are going to get much worse before they get worse. Murphy's ninth law, nature always sides with a hidden flaw. Tenth law, Mother Nature is a bitch. Bowling's postulate, if you're feeling good, don't worry, you'll get over it. Chisholm's second law, anytime things appear to be going better, you have overlooked something. Okay, well, Murphy's whole book is, in a sense, an attempt to help us come to terms with natural evil, or at least the kind of things that can go wrong simply because the world is what it is. But what we have in the case of this story of Herod and the murdered children in Bethlehem is not things going wrong in the world, but the deliberate policy, the deliberate order of a king. It's the kind of thing that finally makes us angry with God altogether. We may not fully understand why there have to be storms and natural catastrophes, but what just drives us up the wall, and you find this in the Psalms all the time, is what people do to each other. And here, not even the kind of random evil of violent men coming into a bank and then after the robbery, shooting randomly the collection of customers who happened to be there on that day. This is planned. This is, in a sense, government policy. This comes very close to the mobilization of the massive machinery of transportation, government, and extermination that we have seen so fearfully in the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel, in his biography, Night, where he writes about his own experiences as a Jewish child in a concentration camp, gives expression to this. On the eve of Rosh Hashanah, 10,000 men had come to attend the solemn service. Everyone is there. Blessed be the name of the Eternal. Thousands of voices repeated the benediction. Thousands of men prostrated themselves like trees before a tempest. Once again the officiant, blessed be the name of the Eternal. But why should I bless him, he says. In every fiber I rebelled. Because he had had thousands of children burned in his pits, because he kept six crematories working night and day, on Sundays and feast days, because in his great might he had created Auschwitz, Birkenau, Buna, and so many factories of death, how could I say to him, blessed art thou, Eternal, Master of the universe, who chose us from among the races to be tortured day and night, to see our fathers, mothers, brothers end in the crematory. Praised be thy holy name, thou who hast chosen us to be butchered on thine altar. On that day, Wiesel says, I ceased to plead. I was no longer capable of lamentation. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I, the accuser, God, the accused. My eyes were open, and I was alone. terribly alone in a world without God and without man, without love and without mercy. I had ceased to be anything but ashes, and yet I felt myself stronger than the Almighty, to whom my life had been tied for so long. I stood amid that praying congregation, observing it like a stranger. This is from Night. It's Wiesel's just sort of two-year biography, the terrible 2 years of his being taken out of a village in Eastern Europe and dumped into Auschwitz, where he finally survived, but his family did not. The question may well be, why talk of such terrible things? Interesting to look through the hymnal once and see how many psalms have been omitted. I started last night doing all of this, but I just finally gave up. One interesting omission is Psalm 137, from which the summer's theme comes. I want to read you Psalm 137, because that's where we got our theme from, but it's also a lament by the Babylonian, by the Jews in Babylonian captivity. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows we hung our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs. Do you have that vivid image, maybe from the Holocaust movie, of Jewish prisoners in concentration camps playing string quartets while other Jews by the hundreds were being marched into the gas chambers? Our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How shall we sing the Lord's song? That's our theme. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites the day of Jerusalem, how they said, raise it, down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, you devastator, happy shall he be who requites you with what you have done to us. Happy shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against a rock. That's the psalm, you see, and it isn't in LBW. This would have to serve us as an example, but the interesting thing is that every time I came to a blank space in LBW and looked it up, it was one of these. It was a psalm full of anger and lament and cries for vindication and do it to them. And those are the psalms that we've left out of LBW. Interesting to ask yourself, too, whether there are any hymns there of lament. We'll sing a few maybe later on. There are some, but boy, not very many. Douglas Hall writes about this in his book, The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches. And he says, in one sense, this refusal to look at the laments or this sort of banishing of that kind of anger from our liturgies and from our devotions is really a sign of our unreality. He talks about sitting in an airliner reading an advertisement for the world of Walt Disney, the real world, the ad says. One of the biggest events of the day was about to happen, a parade. Then they go to the Hall of Presidents where Lincoln, big as life, speaking of the things that make countries great. Then he talks about going into Fort Wilderness and meeting a real blacksmith. And then he concludes by quoting the ad's main point: how your children see the world depends on what you show them. Oh yes, says Hall, I remembered that I had shown my children Buchenwald. I remembered that as we sat outside the Plötzensee Memorial in Berlin, while I told my young sons about the courageous people who had been hanged there for resisting the Nazis, he began to cry and accused me, "Daddy, you tell me the most terrible things. But, says Hall, there are terrible things, and there will be. And when a people determines to protect itself and its children from them, it is quite probable that that people will become the cause of terrible things. It is not only that we will be victims, we may well be the perpetrators of them. Ernest Becker, in a moving series of letters to a chaplain at Syracuse University, writes these words. Becker was the author of The Denial of Death, and he writes these words: "I have lately received such distressing news from the personal lives of almost all of my dearest friends that it would have shaken my whole being if I did not know that we must all fail, that we must all be cheated, that we must all die. When I thought the other day of the real tragedies that have hit two of my friends, I wondered how we could get any feeling of dignity, of meaning, of justification out of our poor lives, and I thought we could do it if we could all stand together somewhere in a cemetery, lowering one of these loved ones into a grave and weeping together like men over our miserable destiny. Then we would experience the heaviness of it, and this would be the bond that ties us together and to the source of all things. We would be justified in our weeping and in our trembling. This is true religion for me, and I think at the same time the surest testimony that it is absent in our world today. We cannot weep and tremble together, but only pretend that everything is all right." Ask yourself once in a while whether it isn't an indictment on the church that people tend to stay away from the church when things go wrong or when they do not feel good enough to be with the people of God, as if church is somehow goodness. Ask yourself whether you really want to know sometime when you say to somebody, "How are you?" You know, do you really want them to tell you how they are? Or do you hope for that, "Fine, you know, okay, everything's all right"? Elizabeth Kübler-Ross discovered to her horror that the dying frequently avoid talking about what is on their minds with us because they are afraid we will run from it, that we, the living, are not able to handle what they are experiencing. And then she found that that when she opened herself to people and really let them know that she would not run from what they wanted to talk about, it would just gush out as in a flood. Well, so why talk of such things? Why take up something so terrible as this incident in Matthew, the murder of the children, or any of the similar terrible things? It is because if we do not do so, we will be part of the terrible unreality of the churches that Hall is talking about. But more positively, Hall's title is The Reality of the Gospel. If we do not have a gospel big enough to encompass this kind of radical evil, then our gospel is a poor word indeed. I want to take just a quick look at one of the ways in which now the Lutheran hymnal deals with this incident in Matthew's gospel. Turn to hymn 177, will you? And let's ask ourselves as we sing this about the adequacy of what they do here. Hymn 177 is a kind of all-purpose, all-saints hymn. And what you do is substitute for verse 2 whichever one fits. Now, the one that fits for the Holy Innocents is verse 9. Do you see it over there on the side? So we'll sing verse 1, verse 2, and then verse 3, and in place of verse 2, substitute verse 9. All right, give us the melody here.
Saints in warfare, for all your saints.
that's the same melody for O God of Earth and Altar, isn't it? I think, yes, my goodness. How do you feel about this second verse? Do you think that's really an adequate response to the murder of the children in Bethlehem? Yes, how do you feel about that?
I mean, that's awful.
It's almost a glorification of death.
Yeah, and that nothing really awful happened.
It seems to me the person that wrote this never really suffered.
I don't want to laugh. A band-aid we get back here, yes.
But a lot of times when a person really suffers, and they meet another person who suffers, they can tell without really having to exchange many words. Mm-hmm. And I think this person hasn't.
Do you think Elie Wiesel would have written this verse? If you contrast what Wiesel writes, God, you know, how can anybody with this, which strikes you as a kind of more honest reaction? Wiesel, yes, in Night. I'm almost loading these questions here. I'm sorry to do that.
Yeah, the absence of God rather than mysterious love, the silence of the face is tragic.
The lack of anger. I mean, you get mad. It doesn't show any anger at all.
Yeah. You surely can't imagine the mothers of Bethlehem singing this song.
Forest lawn, they tell us.
Forest lawn.
They are not there, they are just away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It almost makes it something to be envy. In this.
See, now, one of the things I want to observe here, this is, I think, sort of all predictable, this kind of reaction. I was looking through the hymnal, too, to find stuff, and I came to this, and I thought, how awful to put this in. But then I thought to myself, maybe, just maybe, it's because we're starting here. And that's why I decided to just try this. Let's go through something a little bit. Let's do something, try to do some theological analysis, and then maybe come back to this verse once and see whether it makes a difference if we sing it like at the beginning now or again at the very end. I don't know whether it will, but let's just give it a try. I want to back up and look at the text again then, the text of Matthew 2. The point is, again, that Herod is not engaged in random evil, but in calculated evil. It's part of, in a sense, governmental policy to do this. This is, I guess, this is the thing that bothers me about the victims of governmental policy. I think about this now every time I think about Reagan economics, that the tax cuts are all going to take effect immediately. That is, by October, we are all going to experience what it is like to have our taxes significantly lowered. I've seen all the charts in the magazines and so on. But if at the same time we are having massive budget cuts, particularly in the areas of social programs, school lunches, funding for the arts, CETA, programs for unemployed youth especially, job training, you name the cuts. Now, those cuts are also going to take effect immediately. Reagan's theory is that the income tax cuts will so stimulate the economy that eventually the people who are being affected by the cuts in social programs will also be better off than they are now. But if both sets of cuts take effect immediately, the benefits are going to be more immediately apparent than any long-range aid to the people who are affected by the budget cuts. To be victims, in a sense, of this kind of impersonal operation. I mean, who in Congress sat there and thought actually of individual people as they were voting this sort of thing? I can imagine that Adolf Eichmann didn't think of any individual people at all either. One of the interesting things that someone pointed out when we were in East Germany a year ago was the real difference between Nazism and communism. And the point they were trying to make is that you couldn't appeal to the Nazi government and philosophy to reform itself. The excesses or the problems in Nazism were not mistakes in the vision or flaws in the vision. They were the vision. They were government policy. That it was deliberate, the extermination of the Jews and many of the other things that the Nazis did. In communism, in contrast, what goes wrong is really the failure to live out the vision. One of the jokes in East Germany was that the quarter in Berlin, East Berlin, where the rulers of East Germany were living, was called Volvograd. They weren't all equally badly off in East Germany. Some people were considerably less badly off. One of the other jokes was a question: could the United States become communist? Answer: in principle, yes, but a little country like East Germany can't support two great powers. When they tell stories like this, they are in a sense pointing to the fact that their own system and their own government is not living up to its own vision. That here at least is a system that can be criticized on the basis of its vision. Solzhenitsyn writes in anger that the provisions of the Constitution are not being lived out and carried out in Russia. That his own rights guaranteed to him were not being safeguarded. But government policy, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about here in this instance. But maybe it's worse than that. What's happening here is what Ernest Becker calls the way in which sin invades and is expressed in the generational relationship. It is not just that Herod is doing it, let's say, to a conspiracy against him. He's doing it to another generation. It is one generation murdering another generation. And that is, I think, the deepest level to which we can take the problem of human evil. In his book, Angel in Armor, Becker has an essay that has made the most profound mark on me, namely Kafka on the Oedipus complex. What Becker says here is that the Oedipus conflict is not primarily sexual. He thinks Freud misunderstood the situation here, that it really is the deadly competition between the generations, that when sin invades the generational relationship, and that may well be what original sin is about. Original sin doesn't have anything to do with sex, some of the early Christian fathers thought. Original sin may well have to do with origins, with generations, with the fact that deep in the heart of the parental generation suddenly comes the discovery that the children you have generated, the children you have spawned, are out to replace you. And that whether you like it or not, they can't help it, then you can't help it. I mean, inexorably, minute by minute, hour by hour, year by year, I'm becoming obsolete. And the stronger my children become, the more able they are to replace me. One doesn't notice this at first because they are, in a sense, helpless, and they are, after all, extensions of myself. They are my children, you know. I have brought them into the world. They are jewels in my crown. They are ornaments in my existence. And then all of a sudden they aren't that anymore. All of a sudden they're going to take my place.
And that's when sin invades the whole enterprise. In this bitter, surrealistic Kafka poem, the father and the son engage in mortal conflict, and the father eventually brings about the suicide of the son and exults in it. You know, he has triumphed. We laughed at the song that Judy was singing about the bankers and the diplomats being conscripted for the army. But stop to think about it for a moment. Do you ever wonder whether war may really be the way one generation does it to another? Not perhaps so much the way one country does it to another. We can laugh at the posters, what if they gave a war and nobody came? But the worst part of it is that it is one generation that sends another into mortal conflict, almost as if war is the way the parental generation gets revenge on the generation of its own children. James Michener's book, Kent State, was a horrifying experience for me. Michener's meticulous research into what happened at Kent State has, in a sense, been for me a revelatory moment, because 72% of the people in Ohio approved of what the National Guard did that day when they shot into a crowd of students. The paradox is that none of the students who were killed really were any part of the radical ferment that was going on the Kent State campus. Worse than that, Michener interviewed students and parents after that whole incident and found parents saying to their children when they came home from Kent State, "Why weren't you shot?" What was discovered in Kent State is that the parental generation would not tolerate the student generation of the 60s, and that they were prepared to kill rather than to have that kind of thing going on. If you want to read a really shocking look at the potential for evil in the human heart, you just really ought to read Michener's Kent State. And it's not a plea. It's not a whitewashing. You know, I mean, it's not a whitewashing of students or anybody else. It's a terribly, dreadfully honest book. But it's also no whitewashing of people's attitudes and feelings. Theodore Rozsák, in his Making of a Counterculture, points out how devastating it was for parents to discover that their children were rejecting their values. There we saw the generational conflict unbuffered, uncovered over, you know, unsuppressed, unrepressed, trying to use the right words here, just raw and out in the open. I think maybe that's what we are looking at most deeply here in the story of the murdered children. A king insecure in his power, with right, because kings too are mortal and will die, because power that you take can always be taken from you. The game of King on the Hill can be played endlessly from one generation to the next, insecure in his power and with right, lashing out one last time in a situation where he feels threatened, and doing it to another generation, wiping out the infant population in Bethlehem. In the last analysis, there is no explanation for this. There may be divine empathy, but there will never be an explanation for evil. If we look for explanations, we are either going to end up with something unreal. The devil is doing this, not God, or the Manichaean solution, two gods, two powers, evil in creation, good in escape from creation. Or it will, in fact, by looking evil full in the face, perhaps drive us to madness. Becker quotes G.K. Chesterton, "The common phrase for insanity is a misleading one. For the madman is not the man who has lost his reason. The madman is the man who has lost everything except his reason. You see, all the buffering, all the quilts with which we blanket evil, when they are gone and we look it in the face with only naked reason, then we have to conclude, as Luther does in The Bondage of the Will, that finally God is responsible for evil. And then we will know really why the laments, why the Psalms cry out as they do, sometimes even against God. What Christians do, Stanley Hauerwas says in his book Truthfulness and Tragedy, is that we must have a story big enough to encompass it. Not an explanation, but a story big enough to encompass evil. And that is precisely what the Christian gospel says. And that is why I think in the midst of the gospel we have and can have stories like the murder of the children. Christ is not an explanation, but he is the way God has empathy and expiation for evil in the world. We are looking here not with naked reason, but beyond reason. We are looking not with a buffer between ourselves and evil, but a breakthrough. For one of the questions we need to ask is, what kind of God do we have? Jürgen Moltmann, in a beautiful book on the doctrine of the Trinity, says that finally the roots of the doctrine of the Trinity lie in the suffering of God. That the kind of God portrayed to us in the Bible from Israel on is not a God aloof from our world, but one empathetically involved in its tragedies, in its fate, in its destiny, in its misery, in its evil. And the climax of God's involvement in evil is Jesus himself on the cross. The cry from the cross in Mark's gospel. Mark has only one word from the cross. The cry is, my God, why have you abandoned me? And the great commentary on that, I think, is Romans 8. I was going to do Philippians, but we'll do that maybe tomorrow. Instead, I want to look at even theologians can be wrong and have to correct themselves. So there's a better passage than Philippians, but Romans 8:31. What shall we say to this? If God is for us, who is against us? Yes, but how is God for us? He who did not spare his own son, but now, and the Greek word here is abandoned, paredoken, handed him over. He who did not spare his own son, but handed him over for us all, will he not also give us all things with him? See, the word of the gospel is not a philosophical explanation for evil. The word of the gospel is God abandons, or the Father abandons the Son so that we are not abandoned, and Jesus gives himself over into all of this. That is, I think, the other side of the abandoning. But at any rate, it is, and notice the language here. The Trinitarian language is the language of the generations, of Father and Son, of Father, in a sense, doing it to the Son, and of the Son enduring what is being done with that terrible, awful cry, why have you forsaken me? Why are you doing this to me? That's what the doctrine of the Trinity is about. If we did not have that cry from the cross, we might never have the doctrine of the Trinity. It is not meant to be speculation. It is meant to be that kind of story of God, which tells us that no matter how bad we are to each other, no matter how calculated, no matter how evil, God has entered into our evil at the deepest possible level. Now, that's not the full story There's more, and we're going to sing about that more tomorrow. But today, let's just sing about this part of it. And first of all, maybe Psalm 22 itself. The lament Jesus quotes in his cry from the cross. Psalm 22. Carl, you've got a way for us to do this?
This is a long psalm. One of the problems when we sing psalms on Sunday, after the Old Testament, when you look at it, you see how many verses does it have. You either say, well, it's mercifully short, or it's real long. And I think that musicians do that too, and I'm sure everybody doesn't. When they pick out psalms for worship, they go for the short one. Here's a nice long one, and it gives us a good chance to sing a long one. If you use the psalm tones in the LBW, you can hardly use this. You can use the same psalm tone all the way through, but it gets a little bit monotonous. So I'd like to use two tones and another one, which you don't need to worry about. Let's just divide down it halfway. This will be the first group. This will be the second group. And just to practice how we're going to do it, you all know this tune. This first group, you know the tune.
Psalm 22.
That's on page 224. Not him, 22.
Psalm 22. Everybody got it? And he was doing the last three verses.
Just to practice.
Okay.
Just one other thing. When you chant, you've all experienced that in church, and when you speak the Lord's Prayer, there's always somebody who wants to start the line, or drags way behind. When you're speaking something together, it's always kind of irritating because we want to do it together. The same thing with the psalms. Sing them lightly and easily. And the goal is not to see who gets done first, but to do it as well as we can together. And so what that means practically is that we're going to probably do it just at a little more relaxed, leisurely pace. Okay, so you're going, don't worry if we make a mistake. I'll just start with one, and then we just go around each time. Just very quietly, we'll follow along the thought of the song. My God, why have you forsaken me and are so far from my cry and from the words of my distress?
Oh, my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not answer. My life is well, but I find no rest.
Yet you are the Holy One, enthroned upon the praises of Israel.
Our fathers put their trust in you. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried out to you and were delivered. They trusted you and were not put to shame.
But as for me, I am a poor man, no man, scorned by all and despised by the people.
All who see me laugh me to scorn. They curl their lips and wag their heads, saying, he trusted in the Lord, let him
and kept me safe upon my mother's breast.
I have been entrusted to you ever since I was born. You were my God when I was still in my mother's womb.
Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many young bulls encircle me, strong bulls of Bashan surround me.
They open wide their jaws at me, like a ravening and a roaring lion.
I am poured out like water, all my bones are out of joint. My heart within my breast is melting wax. My mouth is dried out like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth, and you have laid me in the dust of the grave.
Packs of dogs close me in, and gangs of evildoers circle around me. They pierce my hand and my feet. I can count all my bones.
They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. They cast lots for my clothing. Be not far away, O Lord. You are my strength. Hasten to help me.
Save me from the sword, my life from the power of the dog.
Save me from the lion's mouth, my wretched body from the horns of wild wolves.
I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. Praise the Lord, you that fear him. Stand in awe of him, O offspring of Israel. All you that of Jacob's line, give glory.
For he does not despise nor abhor the poor in their poverty, neither does he hide his face from them. But when they cry to him,
my praise is of him in the great assembly. I will perform my vows in the presence of those who worship him. The poor shall eat and be satisfied, and those who seek the Lord shall praise him. May your heart live forever.
All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall bow before him.
For kingship belongs to the Lord, he rules over the nations. To him alone who sleeps in the earth, bow down in worship. All who go down to the dust, fall before him.
My soul shall live for him, my descendants shall serve him. They shall be known as the Lord's forever.
They shall come and make known to a people yet unborn the saving deeds that he has done.
I think the really interesting thing about this psalm is there is, first of all, no explanation of evil. There is just simply the cry in the midst of it, and very moving. I mean, if you paid attention to these words, and then sort of finally the praise of God, the trust in God. And when I looked for lament songs, I didn't find very many in the hymnal, but I thought there were a couple of places where we might sing a verse or two. One is hymn 92. Notice they come, at least some of these, from Lent. Hymn 92. Let's just sing two verses. Notice the tradition from which this comes to.
Were you crucified my Lord, oh.
Thinking maybe our black brothers and sisters have much to teach us about laments, and I'm glad this hymn is there. 96. Let's just sing the first verse of that. There's the first line is for the cantor. Notice that this one comes out of the 16th century, and that it's a Czech hymn. They've always been a kind of minority people, and maybe they know something that we don't know, too. So, the first verse. Why don't you do that?
O God, Father in heaven, have mercy on us.
Your heart, O God, is grieved, we know, by
one other place where there are sort of laments, and this is out of the Reformation tradition. Luther has two hymns of lament in here. One is Out of the Depths I Cry to You, of a hymn form of Psalm 130. That's 295. And let's turn to that and sing just one verse. That's all we've got time for. But Out of the Depths, 295. Problem, I think, with all of these hymns, and this is, in one sense, this is the closest I could come to hymns of lament in the book, is that they finally don't really take up the anger, the outrage that is characteristic of the Psalms. And I wonder if we aren't thereby missing some really important material, some way of giving expression to what we might feel in the face of the kind of planned and radical evil that this lament for murdered children is about. I wonder if this isn't some kind of a deficiency in our piety, in our hymnody, in in what we're able to give expression to. And to the extent that it's absent, to that extent I think Douglas Hall's talk about the unreality of the church is really an indictment upon us. But then I also wonder whether maybe it isn't because we might know something that the lamenters in their lamenting do not know, whether perhaps it isn't the function of the larger Christian community to stand beside those who lament and say, we understand the lament, but we do have more to say than that. Well, it's a good place to end, because tomorrow I want to talk about the church's song as a song of victory. Thank you for being with us today.